conspiracies, endless wars, hidden forbidden history, the depopulation agenda, cryptozoology, mystical visions, hidden mysteries, advanced subterranean civilizations, flying saucers, alien abductions, and secret space programs, time travel, wellness, and healthy living. Where do you go to find out about these subjects and more? To James Bartley's Cosmic Switchboard Show. That's where. James Bartley will provide cutting-edge information and will interview the top investigators and researchers in a variety of fields. Listen in every week to the Cosmic Switchboard Show, hosted by James Bartley.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Andrew Hennessy. Andrew is a veteran UFO researcher from Scotland who has conducted a number of investigations into the Gorebridge, what he describes as a UFO window area. It is a renowned UFO hotspot. Here at the Cosmic Switchboard, we're always interested in knowing more about regional hotspots. So we know about some of the big ones over the years, Gulf Breeze, Florida, and places like that. But we feel that it's important that the listeners get an idea of what's going on in other parts of the world that may not be as well known. So let me tell you a bit about Andrew Hennessy. I've known Andrew for some time now. He was an original member of the Dragon Slayers, which was an online group of people of like-minded interest as far as exposing UFO reality, and especially also is it in regards to the reptilians, too. Andrew Hennessy, born in 1957, Edinburgh, Scotland, has been interested in the UFO phenomenon from a very early age, having had many encounters and experiences, which he wrote in his free e-book, The Turning of the Tide. Andrew Hennessy founded the New Star Party in 1999 as a skeptical and critical dialogue with exopolitics, who to this day have not produced one political manifesto to canvass for the human rights for the victims of alien abuse that has by treaty been permitted by elected governments. He founded Xenopolitics in November 2007 to illustrate the negative and often demonic nature of alien contact. He wrote a free e-book called Harvesting the Disconnected to illustrate his ideas on the alien agenda. Andrew was trained as an industrial biologist and worked in several labs, including the Institute of Terrestrial Ecology, Department of Agriculture and Fisheries, Central Microbiology Lab, National Museum of Antiquities, East of Scotland College of Agriculture, British Geological Survey. In 1984, Andrew formed his theater group called the Solon Company, putting together various original projects in many styles with a veritable army of talented helpers. That Andrew himself is a talented musician who plays traditional Scottish music, and he is highly regarded in the field. I've known him for some time now, so this is quite a treat. Andrew has appeared in various media, the Discovery Channel, Paranormal Magazine, Jeffrey Rentz, Coast to Coast in America, Night Search. He's also been on BBC Uncanny Edinburgh, and today operates the Stargate Edinburgh Tour. So without any further ado, Andrew, how are you?
Oh, hi, James. I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm fine. That was a mouthful. You have quite a background and quite a lot to say about the subject. We kind of go back a long ways because, like I was saying, we used to be members of the Dragon Slayers group, memory serves, and actually a lot of the people today, or some of them anyway, some of the more well-known, highly regarded researchers in our field were actually alma maters of the old Dragon Slayer's days. I can think of a few people.
Wow.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself for the listeners that may not be familiar with you or your work?
Well, my own kind of UFO research kind of falls into kind of four categories. I've got my own close encounters and analysis of those, and the close encounters start from a kind of early age. And then they didn't look like alien then. It just seemed like it was the sort of stuff you discuss in spiritualist halls and things like that. So I eventually joined a spiritualist group and trained as a spiritualist medium, but that was a stupid thing for me to have done, I reckon. And I soon backed out of that, and then I headed on down to Reptilian Central at the Theosophical Society, and and then ultimately joining all sorts of weird groups. And then I eventually decided that being a Knights Templar wasn't for me. I decided I wasn't going to join the Rosicrucians or whatever else the liberal Catholics. They had all sorts of groups. Bonpo Buddhism actually had as well. I decided I wasn't going to do any of that, and I formed my own discussion group called the Transformation Studies Group in 1996. Around about, and we had some great scholars and mystics and people of all persuasions and inverted commas reptilian races went there as well, and we had some interesting discussions. It was quite a group, and then ultimately I left the Theosophical Society. It had its own turmoils round about the millennium in Scotland. There was some people characterise it as the Great Shaking or whatever, but the organisation went through some sort of tumultuous schism, but it all came back together again. But I'd had enough by that time, and I went off and did my own thing. I ultimately, believe it or not, became kind of Christian, but that was my choice around about 2006. Because I had all these close encounters, you see. There were some pernicious, horrible close encounters. Around about the year 2003, it all kind of came to a head. But in the decades leading up to that, there have been these close encounters, and I was very pleased to have been saved. I mean, clearly there's been some intercessions that have kept me kind of reptilian free, you know, and there's this demonic stuff going on, alien demonic stuff going on. And that's the most harrowing encounters that I've had. Despite that, though, I'm still singing and dancing.
yes, and it's always important for everybody keep a good vibe about this, and nothing keeps a vibe high better than to have uplifting music. And I've always had this affinity for Scottish and Irish and Gaelic music in general. It just triggers all these past life feelings and emotions within me. And it sounds corny, but to this day, whenever I hear traditional Scottish music, my hands go behind my back and I start doing a jig, even if I'm sitting down. This happens, and it still happens to this day. You mentioned that you'd had experiences throughout your life. Could you describe some of your earliest memories that have happened to you of an ET or a kind of a fairy nature?
Yes, I mean, some of the earliest ones I can remember. I'm lying in my cot with the bars up and all at the age of two or three, and there's a picture on the end of my cot. And there's this guy punting. He's got a pole, and he's punting a little barge across the river. Now, that was just somebody taking the boat. It's very Hades kind of artwork, that, when you think about it, that he's punting his little punts across the crossing the stream to get to the other side, you know. Anyway, I'm lying looking at that, and then the water starts moving, like I'm looking at a digital TV. I'm looking at the scene. Then I look up above my head, and there's this sort of shimmering above my cot, and suddenly I'm having this highly intelligent conversation with whatever it was, an angel I suppose, or reptile, I don't know, no idea. But anyway, it says, "Are you sure you want to do it this way?" And it's quite a highly evolved conversation for a three-year-old to have. So, you know, we just step outside the usual understanding of human evolution and just look at this conversation I'm having with this being. I said, "Yes, I am very sure, thanks very much." And whatever that was, whatever this way was, probably the most disconnected way from the whole reptilian genre you could think of, I suspect. Thankfully, I was very lucky to avoid getting... you know, you have to avoid these things when you can. But my life I in the garden is very otherworldly. I used to play with soldiers and stuff like that out in the garden, and then the colonel would live in the apple tree. I would get you know, something would try and direct my play behavior and all that sort of stuff. And, so anyway, ultimately, you bear in mind that I actually left all that stuff behind, but it took a long time. And then when it started becoming a bit more crossover, a bit more kind of alien in around about 1980, my first bedroom encounter that I could identify as a bedroom encounter, which is some sort of glowing light. I'm lying in my bed and I see this glowing light. I thought I left a light on in the room, a table lamp, but it wasn't. It was a fizzy orb that came to the foot of my bed and all that stuff. Don't be afraid. If you're afraid, pull the covers over your head. Well, I did. I pulled the covers over my head. But when I came to, I was tucked up in bed tightly and all that stuff. And that's the sort of stuff that Professor John Mack talks about in his bedroom encounters. But although this seemed to be it seemed to be like it was at that time in 1980, there was no Whitley Strieber, and there was nothing prior to that. And when you realise that these kind of encounters that have been going on with people have been going on for a long, long time, centuries, millennia, this kind of thing's been going on for a long time, certainly in Scotland, and people would traditionally take their sons and daughters to be baptised or leave iron crosses or objects of iron to stop the demonic or the fairies doing that to their children. This was going on in my childhood. And by the time I get to my kind of younger adulthood, it turned into like almost hand-to-hand with aliens at that
point. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the fairies' ancient connection with Scotland. The reader should be aware of at least a couple of books. One of them was written by William Evans Wentz, called The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries. I believe it was written around 1909, very early 20th century. And William Evans Wentz was an American who went around to the Celtic countries and interviewed people about the lore of the wee folk, the fae, the fairies, the gentry. There are a variety of names for them, for these otherworldly types of beings that had a habit of abducting people. And even in some of the stories that go back in antiquity, there is even a relativistic aspect to some of the stories, wherein a story would play out where somebody was taken by the wee folk, by the fairies, and then when he or she was returned, in what only seemed to be a short time with the fairies, they're brought back to their village, and years, decades, and centuries have passed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, even in some of the stories of way back then, there was a relativistic aspect. Another story, another book, is known as The Science of Fairy Tales, written by E.S. Hartland. I think this was in the late 19th century. It was mentioned prominently, both books, by Jacques Vallée in his earlier works like Passport to Magonia and Dimensions. And again, The Science of Fairy Tales is a very serious, sober study of what has been described as fairies, wee folk, elves, leprechauns, so on and so forth. And it should be mentioned that to this day, and not only in the Celtic countries, but in the Arctic Circle, places like Iceland, there is a common belief held by many people in the existence of elves, in the existence of fairies, of beings that live in the ground and live in other dimensions which transect, if you will, our world. Now, coming into adulthood, you were still interested in the subject matter. I mean, you had mentioned some of the groups you were part of, the Theosophical Society. Well, what was that like for someone who's never been in the Theosophical Society? I've read a bit about Blavatsky and her group and some of her beliefs. What was it like being on the inside?
Well, I mean, I met a lot of characters there from the alphabet soup, you know, the sort of people that David Icke writes about. But the Theosophical Society has got three aims and objects, and that is to, the universal brotherhood of man, comparative studies of philosophy, religion, and science, and investigate the powers latent in man and nature and stuff like that. Well, it had three objects. Well, technically, that's the Theosophical Society that everybody thinks exists. But there's another Theosophical Society called the Secret School that operates the Theosophical Society behind the scene. And it doesn't have three objects. It has, I think, about six objects or something. And some of those are involved in investigating and controlling aspects of the society. So the esoteric society is the secret school, and there's the exoteric society. So if you go through the doors of the Theosophical Society, you're in the exoteric society with its three wonderful objects, but manipulating that behind the scene is the secret school, and there are various other objects as well. I didn't get to find out what they all were, but one day actually I was poking about in one of the cupboards of the Theosophical Society, as you do. And I came across this, yeah. So, I mean, I discovered a couple of interesting things in the covers of the Theosophical Society I should tell you about. But one of the things I came across was this degree. It was a degree. Now, I was into, at that time, interestingly enough, I was into threeness and the threeness of nature. I was in developing some sort of three-part knowledge representation thing for computing, and I was into threeness and a general systems theory of threeness. So here I've discovered this theory of threeness in the cupboards of the Theosophical Society, and it's had written in green ink on it, "In the event of my death, please destroy." So I had a look through that, and it's the same kind of threeness that I had, except it had the same ideas, but they were all had some kind of Hindu glossary on it. So it was threeness in a glossary sort of, in a Hindu sort of way, with a, and you look at the glossary at the back, it just relates to all kind of theosophical encyclopedias and the secret doctrine and all this kind of thing. So, but it was interesting that there's another thing I discovered at the Theosophical Society, which I find quite interesting. It was 19th century Book of Josephus. Josephus Flavius, The Secret History of the Jews. Now, it was the original text. It was a huge, big text. And in that, let me just tell you, I've never been able to find online. You know, you can go to sacredtexts.org or whatever online, and you can get this Secret History of the Jews by Josephus Flavius. You can download it, you can browse it, but you'll never find in it the chapter that I seem to find in this book, this printed book at the Theosophical Society. Is an ancient text, maybe 18th or 19th century textbook, huge big book, you know, bound to these old, I don't know if it was what it was bound in, goodness knows, but obviously it wasn't bound in flesh, right? it wasn't one of these books, but I mean it's this big book. I opened it up and I discover the names of the fallen angels. Now that is interesting. You'll not find. I mean, there's just one I remember with Samuel. Now Samael. Now that is the leader, the ringleader, or whatever. But the thing is that there were other angels named as well, whose names I didn't really want to remember, to be honest with you. But there were other. And you'll not find this nomenclature in the online versions. Somebody has whicked them out. Now, why would that be, I wonder? Somebody tried to cover up the tracks, yeah?
Do you think that the book may have had references or passages that dealt with invocation of some of these angels, if you will?
Oh, I didn't read it that quickly, because I just went into the call it the Golden Dawn Room, all the archives.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't Golden Dawn Room then, but it was in its time rented out to Gregor Mathers, but the Theosophical Society discontinued that. So, you know, the Golden Dawn no longer were in contact with the Theosophical Society, to my knowledge anyway, but the archives were laid out in this room that the Golden Dawn used to use, and apparently in this room there's been interesting phenomenon and events going on, you know, paranormal stuff going on. They said that there was this etheric pyramid in the middle of the floor, and that there was a thing in that room at one point. And they got on various people over the years to try and exorcise it. They had a Bonpo Lama tried, it was a Gnostic Rosicrucian tried, a mage. He called himself as a kind of magus, and he tried to exorcise the room, but it was always crashes and noises, like huge four-drawer filing cabinets seemed to keep hitting the floor from a great height, the building would reverberate. anyway, that room was a bit of an unquiet room, but you wouldn't really want to go in there too often to sort of browse the archives, you know. But anyway, I did go and have a look at this Secret History of the Jews. I don't know about the invocations. I didn't read the book. It was that much of that. It's a big book. to get through, and it's kind of I just managed to identify the chapter on fallen angels and had a look at that, but it isn't the same. I tried to relocate that online and couldn't. The actual information seems to be not there amongst the stuff that's now online today.
Now, you've been at the forefront of investigations into the Gorebridge area. Now, if memory serves, Gorebridge is a suburb of Edinburgh, not too far from it, and there seems to be a lot of ET paranormal activity there, to the point where it seems to have garnered the attention of these deep black spook agencies. Could you tell us what you found in your investigations? Give us an idea, a panoramic view, if you will, of what goes on in the Gorebridge area, and tell us where it is exactly.
Right. Well, the Gorebridge is an ex-mining town, so it's full of kind of flooded or semi-flooded ex-coal mines, about 16 miles south of the Scottish capital, and as you say, it's a suburb within commuting distance of Edinburgh. Historically, from the Middle Ages, there's been strange things going on there. I mean, one of the last witches in the area was burnt not too far from there, this kind of thing. I mean, it's the fairy lore, fairy parades, fairy culture. It's been ongoing, but came to my attention in 1999, actually, the stories I started to hear from a gentleman called John Jackie Gillies, who was a cameraman out in Gorebridge. He's filming the most extraordinary stuff going on there. And it's not just lights in the sky he was filming either. I'll tell you about those in a minute. But John Jackie Gillies was filming extraordinary alien activity, paranormal activity was going on in his house, in his garden and all that. But he had stories of what was going on. Now, there isn't just John Jackie Gillies, who you can find on YouTube as Skywatcher Scotland. That's his YouTube handle. But he films stuff every night there, and he's always uploading stuff. Recently, I must admit, he's gravitated more back to lights in the sky. But his older stuff is about UFOs taking off from fields and things like that, cattle mutilations locally. He's got some cattle mutes on film and stuff like that. So, but anyway, the area is highly strange. The people will go walking up the top of this hill. Now, the hill is called, it's got various names, this hill. The Romans, a Roman camp used to be on the top of it, and it was called the Roman camp. The Gorebridge is kind of around this hill. It was also an old disused coal mine, open cast coal mine called Blinkbonny Mine, and it's also locally known as Gowk's Hill, Gowk, G-O-W-K. Now, a Gowk in Scotland is traditionally a man that's away with the fairies, and you'll find a lot of references to Gowk in Scottish lore. You see Gowk's Moss near Roslyn and stuff like that. Now, the thing is that the locals have been walking up in Gowk's Hill, taking their dogs and going for a walk up there and all that sort of stuff, and they're being chased out the woods by lights, alien creatures, all sorts of strange holographic type things manifesting. I'll give you an example of when I started hearing of this. I wanted to go and check out the Camp Hill with John Gillies, and we got in our car and we went up the little narrow road that goes to the hilltop. And we were going up there, and there's a car behind us. I could see I'm driving. There's a car behind us, and it's a big 4x4, kind of dark 4x4. And there's a couple of old guys in it coming. There's a couple of old guys in it, and all the gentlemen look like country gentlemen in their suits and ties and stuff like that. And they passed us. These country gentlemen passed us. Then the car went up ahead. It did a quick 3-point turn, and it came back towards us. And then it's a couple of young guys, look like spooks, sitting in the front. A quick shapeshift, quick change, and there you have an example of the kind of high strangeness you'll see in the Gorebridge area. Other things you'll see in that area, you'll see weird military vehicles, strange gothic-looking aircraft with lightning coming from their wingtops. You'll see hedge witches materialising, manifesting. There'll be UFOs parked up in the local fields, domes in the local fields. Some of the domes have been there. And in the 1980s, there was a dome parked up in the local fields for a couple of weeks, apparently. That was reported. And there's recently, John Gillies' footage has picked up on big containers coming, emerging in an etheric way out of the fields, where the, you know, the mines are underneath and all that sort of thing. Things coming in and out of the field. I've been down there, I've been taking photographs, and I've got some UFOs, I've got an alien running across the roof. One of the stories that got my attention was and John Gillies and his wife are lying upstairs in their bedroom one night, and they hear a crash downstairs, smashing. And they go down, they run downstairs, and they see that their glass coffee table had been smashed into 1,000 smithereens, and that the smithereens were writhing across the floor like a snake. So that was seen. And John Gillies' Rottweiler called Missy, who's now dead, but his Rottweiler leapt to his defence, and some kind of invisible arm picked it up by the throat and dangled it in the air. It's very demonic. And
wow.
This stuff is it seems to have, the demons have silver suits these days, but very demonic stuff going on. So the local mines, the local area from, is about maybe 100 square miles of weirdness there, actually, you know. And I think it's extensive cavern systems that go back to ancient times, I think. Photographs, shape-shifting cars. You know, cars that in the space of a few seconds have gone from something that looks like a shoe, like a white shoe, to a white saloon car in a matter of seconds. You know, it's just weird stuff happening there.
I've heard similar stories. Bill Hamilton, a well-known researcher from Southern California, he and his wife Pam were out by the black mailbox, if memory serves, near Area 51, and he was out there sky watching in the middle of the night looking towards the test range, and a strange car drove behind him as he stood out there in the middle of the night. And the odd thing about it was this car did not make any noise, the kind of sounds you associate with a passing vehicle, the tires on the pavement, the sound of the motor, none of that. And he said that they had a very strange appearance to it. It went driving by. Next thing you know, he looks at his watch, and he realizes 15 minutes had gone by at least. So he'd undergone a missing time experience. Right after that strange vehicle drove by, he started stomping his feet and jumping up and down in anger because he was very scrupulous about keeping track of time. Long story short, he wound up getting taken on board a saucer by a 6-foot-tall gray, and his wife was taken into a van by apparent military personnel where they messed with an ocular implant in her eye. Yes, I've heard of stories of vans shape-shifting and vehicles, and I've also quite recently have seen photographs of what was supposed to be in the images was three men in black in dark suits and glasses, classic spook-looking individuals walking outside of a slowly moving van that had been parked in front of the house of a MyLab. And when the MyLab looked out the window and noticed them, they very noticeably and obtrusively decided to leave at that moment. They escorted the van as it slowly pulled away and parked further down the street. And the individual in question took a series of photographs of this. Lo and behold, when the images were looked at in the mobile phone, one did not see the spooks. They only saw the vehicles, the vehicle rather, which was odd because these three spooks in suits and dark glasses were standing right outside of the van as it moved slowly away. Yeah. At least three photographs were taken. So the people, they could have been beings or reptilians even, did not show up in the images, but the van did.
This holographic process is ongoing now. Whether or not, I know that the reptilians can make themselves invisible.
Yes.
And that the greys can just seem to be able to do that. They can, but you know these images. I mean, there was this. For instance, at Gorebridge, where this John Gillies got this phone call from this gentleman called. I'll remind me to tell you about the harassment he's had as well. But I mean,
yes, please.
He got a phone call from this gentleman called Colonel Joe, who was a big fan apparently of him and all that. And he said he was head of alien security, because this is all based as a mining area. Is the town assimilated, by the way? Is there a Matrix-like thing going on with Gorebridge? I don't know. But it does seem there's a lot of strange stuff going on in the streets at street level. It's been filmed at night and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, so John gets this a phone call from Colonel Joe, who says, listen, I've got something to tell you about this area, something to share with you about the area. Could you come and meet me at Vaugirey Park? Which is it's a park not very far from the Gorebridge area. It's still in that area, but it's, could you come and meet me? So John gets out of his house and he decides he's going to walk there. So he's halfway down the road, and then up pulls his dark, black, classic Bentley sort of thing that you'd associate with a man in black type car, you know, an ancient vintage
yes.
car. And out comes Colonel Joe in the grey tweed suit with the silvery hair and this kind of thing. He says, "Hello, I'm Colonel Joe." He says, "I want," and he brings out this technology, which he says will neutralize any kind of surveillance, and he puts it on the hood of his car, and on the bonnet of his car, and proceeds to tell John Gillies that he's 1 in 10, and that he produces 1950s maps of the area. Didn't really tell him anything, to be honest with you. I don't think John got to learn really anything. Anyway, so. The thing about John is he's a subject of ongoing surveillance, and he can't leave his house unless he's getting followed by somebody or something. So he'll go on these walks, he'll go and film stuff. He's found like hobbit hole entrances to the underworlds around there and this kind of thing, and found it's just incredible the things that have happened to that family. But anyway. As a cameraman in Scotland, he's one of a rare breed of active and ongoing cameraman in Scotland. And for some reason, they all seem to get visited by this very burly, strong-willed sort of ex-military team. They'll go out skywatchers, and you know they're not so prominent once they get targeted, I think. Anyway, John was invited out with this bunch of ex-military people who posted videos of themselves sliding down scree on a steep Scottish hillside. Obviously, that's a very military thing to do, to be able to do that, you know. You have to be very fit or stupid, a combination of both, to want to do that. But anyway, they decided they were going to invite John out for a skywatch. So I had to bring his camera and show them some stuff. But I think he declined that. And I had another friend called Paul. Paul and I went out. Paul was if ever was anybody going to bring Gorebridge to prominence, it was Paul Muir. He was a very, very well-known, who had run his own tour business. He was almost on TV, and he was a bit of a celebrity, and he in media, he's credible as well. So we got Paul out. I decided I was going to drive Paul around and show him some of the stuff out there. And when Paul got home, he found thousands of pounds worth of stolen camera gear on his doorstep.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it just shows you. I suspect that what it was is that the local surveillance team probably wanted the very latest stuff. You know, they probably wanted the very latest HD stuff, so they decided to write that off as a sort of field expense, you know. So they were probably putting it in a requisition form for the latest hardware, and what we're going to do with this stuff. You know, they're thinking to themselves, well, we better put it to some use to get rid of it quick. And I probably dumped it. So I asked Paul to report that to the police, because obviously if he started using it, then he's an accessory to some kind of criminal deed that they had yet to invent. But this is what's going on. There's phone calls, there's this harassment. And luckily for us, we've been able to keep putting our stuff out on Google. Now, one of the things I have out on Google, on my own YouTube account called Outshore, one of the things I have is footage of paragliders circling high in the heaven and coming to land on a hovering UFO platform.
Huh.
Now, to me, I mean, that's been up on Google and YouTube for nearly 7 or 8 years now, and it's only had a couple hundred hits. How so? I mean, okay, right, the images, just to clarify this, the images are blurry, you know, but you can make out the paragliders circling. They're two-diamond-shaped UFOs, which the MOD have been known to interact with, the makers of these diamond-shaped UFOs are hovering there. And in the middle of these two hovering diamond-shaped UFOs is this platform. It's a circular platform with these theatrical lighting, blue light, yellow light, red light on it. You know, you've got these lights on it. The paragliders, who I presume are human, are circling above it, and they land on it. They land on it. He's got footage of them landing on the platform. Now, it's not clear footage. It's not stuff that you'd get a cameraman of the Year Award for, but it does show human cooperation, or alleged human cooperation, with these aliens. And this is out at the Gold Ridge area as well.
Yes, I've heard of similar stories in Southern California. There is some kind of a craft that is flown out of one of the underground bases there, and it's been described as looking like kind of like a large hangar-looking thing. We had two different remote viewers, both very good at what they did, both well into their, at the time, well into their 50s and 60s. They've been doing this kind of work for a while, and they'd each individually remotely viewed an underground base that a number of my lab friends of mine had been taken to, basically kidnapped and taken into. And it was a joint military reptilian base. And they both had independently observed through remote viewing this kind of large kind of kite kind of device that was being utilized by the people on the inside. And the way they described it is similar to what you described. It was a large kind of a kite kind of device that I thought was kind of odd, and I didn't know what to make of it, so I just kind of put it on the back shelf and, you know, waited for kind of confirmation to come along, and here you are many decades later telling me about this.
Aye. And while John was filming this, he was being attacked by kind of fairy lights or demonic orbs or however you want to put it, but he was being buzzed as he was filming this by some intelligent glowing entity or reality was buzzing him. So they were aware he was filming, I think.
Now, it sounds like John has had interference from deep black spooks. Has he reported, besides the lights and the orbs harassing him, has he described encounters with entities that have come and messed with him and try to intimidate him or anything like that?
Well, he's got footage of something that looks like, you know, that Doom 2 game, you know, when you're playing Doom or whatever.
Yes.
So it's like one of these creatures pacing up and down the top of his roof.
Really?
Aye. It really just looked like it was like one of those little loops in the video game where these creatures are. Anyway, so it's a very demonic. Again, it's not so much alien, but quite demonic. He's had this stuff in his back garden. He hears sounds at night. He'll open his curtains and there's some grey with some kind of physical technological device beaming frequencies at his house and stuff like that. There's interesting things going on out at Gorebridge that can be kind of, the actual human side of it is that the government doesn't want to know. Officially doesn't want to know, but unofficially, they are quite interested in what's happening out there. I discovered there's an industrial estate out there, just above all the flooded coal mines and things like that. There's this company called Dryden Aqua. Now, Dryden Aqua, I'm not saying they're bad guys or there's anything wrong with them. I'm just noting for a research point of view that there's a company specialising in industrial runoff water. You know, it's the sort of water that, you know, if you're in a big mine in Australia or Brazil, big strip mining, and the water gathers into a pool that will be full of toxic, highly toxic concentrations of metallic ions and stuff like that. And big mining companies, and these massive big mining companies would get out Dryden Aqua to do these lagoons, they're called, where the sediment would settle out and they try and purify the water. Well, that's not Dryden Aqua, but what's Dryden Aqua? I mean, the coal mines in Scotland, those mines closed in the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher shut down most of the industry in Scotland.
Yes.
So what's Dryden Aqua? Even a small unit, industrial unit of Dryden Aqua, what are they doing out in Gorebridge? The last place in the world you'd expect to see a company like that, I'm thinking, but maybe I'm wrong, I have no idea, but for some reason, There's an that area does have a a water problem. There's no doubt there are people reporting red patches in the grass where the water's rising up, stuff like that. And also other underground activity there appears to be alien stuff coming out the fields, parked up in the fields and coming out from under the fields in like a semi-out-of-phase technology rising up, semi-materialised, rising up out the fields and flying off. That's going on there as well. So maybe the aliens have a local problem with all the other stuff, all the industrial waste that's in that area too.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't surprise me. They seem to have an interest certainly in the cattle, and they certainly have an interest in a lot of the flora and fauna. They've been observed different ETs for centuries, actually, obtaining samples of different types of plants and whatnot. In the famous series of books about Betty and Drace, and in the book The Watchers, which is the third book in the series, she describes being inside of a spaceship, and there's what amounts to an alien botanist there in her presence, a little gray-looking guy, and he's messing with these plants, basically, and he's telling her telepathically that his particular race collects basically every seed and every plant on Earth for whatever purpose. So Dr. Carla Turner used to make jokes about him, saying that these aliens must be a lot dumber than we think because they keep coming back and grabbing the same plants over and over again. Now, you mentioned other hot spots, such as Bonny Bridge, the Falkirk Triangle. Could you describe what those places are like, and are they in close proximity to Gorebridge?
Well, Scotland, it's not like it's a state in the United States or a state in Australia. Scotland's got a small place, really. It's not. So, like, you've got Gorebridge, which is in Mid Lothian, and that's just think of the every aspect of this area. I think is historically undermined, or underground dwellings and all that in this whole area. And that's central. It's called Central Scotland. So you've got Mid Lothian, and you've got East Lothian. You've got a place called Goblin Halls in East Lothian, and pretty much there's collectors meditating with the goblins in the Goblin Hall area and stuff like that. And then in West Lothian, you've got the famous Tarbrax abduction. The A70 abduction took place in West Lothian. And then just north of that, you've got the Falkirk and the Falkirk Triangle. Falkirk Triangle between Falkirk and... To be honest, the area is not just triangular. There's pretty much... That whole area, the Falkirk, Stirling, and then south towards Edinburgh, that area was in the 1990s. That was considered to be one of Scotland's primary UFO hotspots, and there were reasons for that. I suppose there might well have been industrial toxins in that area. Maybe the greys were coming out, doing biosamples, biopsies on the people that they might be abducting, or I don't know, but for sure one of the stories from that area is the A70 abduction that you don't often hear. It's Gary Wood and is it Colin Wright, I think. Colin was taken away, and same thing, the Gary Wood story you can see online, but Colin was taken away underground as well. And he was taken into this cavern, and this cavern was lined with glass jars, or Perspex jars, full of naked people that were frozen. They had them stripped, and they had them dunked in a glass jar as well. They're about to freeze them, and he's going, "No, no, 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 you will not, no, no, no." And so they let him go. He didn't want to have a contract with them. He didn't agree with what they were doing, and so they let him go. I mean, that's what I think anyway. However, it does suggest that area in Scotland is, historically got a lot of happening that of an otherworldly nature. Gary Wood was taken underground into these caverns and was introduced to the Emperor Grey or whatever it was. He said, "Well, what do you want here?" He says, "Sanctuary." Interestingly, the area around there, there's an area around there that was an ancient Templar, Knights Templar sanctuary called the Priory of Turficken. It was an old Templar hospital as well, and so interesting the connections. There is stuff happening. Now I was going to tell you about one aspect of Bonnybridge, that area called the Falkirk Triangle, the UFO Triangle, it was also known to lottery winners as the Golden Circle, because people could win lottery so often in there that if you went to win the lottery, you would buy a lottery ticket in the Golden Circle. All sounds very nice and glamorous, that, doesn't it? My goodness, these nicey fairies and aliens are giving us lottery wins. Now, that same area of West Lothian or was also known as, in The Lord of the Rings, that was Lothlorien, the ancient kingdom of King Lot. In that area, there's a lot of tie-ins between The Lord of the Rings, the names from The Lord of the Rings tie into this area as well. Things like the Dúnedain, Aragorn, son of Arathorn, in Lord of the Rings, the coming king, he was of the stewards. You know, he would replace the stewards of Gondor, and he was of the Dúnedain. Well, Dúnedain is Edinburgh's Gaelic name. And then you've got the dwarfs, of course, in the dwarf kingdoms, but you had the Lothlórien of King Lot, of the Lothians. You had the Blackstone of Eric, in Lord of the Rings, which is where the Oathbreakers were summoned to. That's the Stone of Destiny. The Stone of Eric is the Stone of Destiny in Scotland. So there's quite a lot of tie-ins between the mystical lore of Tolkien even and this area where all the abductions and... Now, interestingly, in that area, which at Bonnybridge, there is a monument to dark abducting forces. Now, people don't say, come to Scotland and see the monument for dark abducting forces. No, they don't say that. That's not tourist stuff. That. So what they say is, come and see the Kelpies. Now, these are big metal horses rearing out of the ground. Two big metal horses' heads. And these are the Kelpies. Now, the Kelpies, if you look up your wiki or whatever you want to do, the Kelpies were dark abducting water horses, dark spirits. Now, not very far from where the Kelpies are was the site of where King Arthur was supposed to have been wounded mortally by Mordred in the last Arthurian battle. Now, there was this Christian king being preferably slain by the dark Mordred, not very far from where the Kelpies are, in fact.
Well, that's interesting. And I've read a bit about Roslyn Chapel. How far as the crow flies is Roslyn Chapel from Gorebridge? Is it in the same vicinity?
Same vicinity. So you've got Gorebridge, and then you've got this place called Temple. That's the ancient Templar Priory of Ballantradoch, but they just call it the village of Temple now. And between this Gorebridge, there's Temple, and then not that far down the road is Roslyn, part of that same rivers and streams and things like that. They're all in that area, Roslyn Glen, Roslyn Chapel, and then... But it's a good, you know, up to 10 miles... southwest of Gorebridge is Roslyn, but that it's just interesting that all that area is underpinned by caverns and cavern systems, and also the history of beings that have lived in these cavern systems. You get stories of werewolves there as well, believe it or not. So that whole area has got a lot going for it, and if you ever want to come to Scotland and check it out, just you know, look me up. I'll give you some pointers in the right direction. And
I might just take you up on that. Like in some of the accounts of described in the books I mentioned earlier by William Evans Wentz, The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries, he talks about how some of these wee folk, described as the gentry and with other names, how they live in the grottos. They live basically in the mountains. They live in the earth. And what's interesting is for many centuries, the miners were obliged in many places in Europe to sign what we would now describe as, or now know as, non-disclosure statements, because apparently it was normal for miners to see very strange and sometimes scary things in the mine shafts, in the tunnel systems. And as you know, because so many of these places, like you described, they have naturally occurring cavern systems beneath, any number of subterranean creatures and or civilizations can reside in these places. So sometimes the twain will meet where a mine shaft will be dug, and then these miners will be picking away, and then whammo, they connect with a pre-existing large cavern system, and there may be entities there, and some of them may not be very pleased to see them, right? So what they would do is they would make these people sign these non-disclosure statements and threaten them, you know, with violence even, if they went around talking about their stories.
Aye. There's a tie-in with that sort of thing to the story of Rosalind. I mean, many people say that under Rosalind is the Templar treasure is stored in the caverns under there, and Mary, Queen of Scots, paid a visit to Rosalind, and she promised to keep secret what she'd seen there. That's Mary, Queen of Scots, in dire straits. Mary, Queen of Scots ended up having a hard time, but she did promise to keep secret, and still did, obviously, because nobody ever found out the secret that Mary, Queen of Scots, discovered there. However, people are saying that there's a Holy Grail under there, the Mari Celestis in the caverns under there, there's all sorts of things. But that Rosalind took the National Coal Board to court and tried to sue them, because Rosalind was Rosalind Chapel Trust was in the process of restoring Rosalind Chapel, and they were complaining that their lintel, their door was subsiding. And they blamed the subsidence of their door on the National Coal Board, because they said that the Scottish Coal Board had been undermining their chapel. But when they took the Scottish Coal Board to court, and there were two people who took them to court, there was the Catholic Church at Rosewell. Rosewell sued the Coal Board, and Rosalind Chapel sued the Coal Board. And the reason why only Rosewell was successfully suing the Coal Board was because the Coal Board produced maps of their mines and galleries and showed conclusively that they never ever had any coal mining under Rosalind. So this story therefore confirms the fact that there is caverns under Rosalind Chapel.
Wow, that doesn't surprise me at all. And so many of these ancient temples, and even going further back, the megalithic stone circle sites, they happen to be along ley lines, dragon lines, emitting telluric energy. And the Knights Templars, for example, seem to have a lot of esoteric knowledge. A lot of the cathedrals they built throughout Europe were basically part of this grid of ley lines and dragon lines that were spread throughout Europe and throughout Scotland and places like that. And what's interesting is the Templar tie-in, that if we're to believe the conventional history, the Templars had to flee because they were being persecuted. Apparently, some of them made their way to Scotland and basically had a hand in the creation of Rosalind Chapel. And since they were well known in the past to be miners themselves, or at least would pay or otherwise suborn others to do the mining and digging for them. I mean, you think back to the temple in the Holy Land. Well, suddenly they wind up in Rosalind Chapel, and there happens to be underground caverns beneath that very site. That's very interesting.
Yes, yes. I mean, a lot of people have paid, I think, with their lives for trying to dig around that area, the temple area, where the old Knights Templar Priory was, because basically there's a big rumor that when the Templars fled Europe, they came to the Edinburgh area, they came to Scotland, and the three treasure ships landed on the Isle of May. And apparently they had bought the Isle of May, the Isle of Maidens. They bought that from the Order of St. Adrian for, I think it was the equivalent of three times the gross national product of Scotland at the time. They paid a huge amount of money for the Isle of May. And arguably, allegedly, they landed their treasure there. Now, one guy, ex of MI6, I think, bought a hotel near the place where the private beach that the Templars allegedly landed that treasure. And apparently, I remember him showing me he was talking about some papal bull that in the year 1300, 112, I can't remember, it was 1350, it was that area, just after the Battle of Bannockburn, the Pope made a demand on the Templars to hand over a section of that treasure. So basically Stephen Prior had a copy, I didn't actually see it physically, but he just told me he had a copy of the papal bull that had been issued, basically a tax return from the Vatican wanting a slice of the Templar stash. And apparently that Templar treasure, Stephen Prior is no longer with us. I think he prematurely left this world. And there's another guy also who's no longer with us who seemed to be looking for the Templar treasure out at the village of Temple. And apparently he got himself American backing and stuff like that, and he'd found steps going down, etc., etc. But he kind of was... Arguably, maybe his lifestyle, because he was fond of his sherry and his cigars and all that, but I do think that he's... You know, everybody that I know that knew anything about where the Templar treasure could be is no longer with us. Interestingly, John Gillies was having a walk in that area, and he found this cavern, and it had this brooch with a Pegasus on it. That could be a Templar brooch, maybe one of the Templar houses. But anyway, he found his brooch, a Pegasus brooch out there. And interestingly enough, I've had on my tours, I've had concerned Edinburgh businessmen. I don't know what they're concerned about, but I've had any of these people out having a look. And apparently there's somebody interested, from the Uri Geller camp has been interested, one of Uri Geller's acquaintances, an ex-SES interrogator apparently, he's obviously not doing SES interrogating today. Well, we don't know that, but I mean, maybe he is or maybe he's not, but he's now a cabaret artist doing mind games. He was interested in finding out about this. I think John Gillies seemed to know a lot about the local cavern systems out there, and he was always having a look around. But thankfully, he's not been offed. But most of the people I know that could have had any knowledge of the documents and documentation of that area are now no longer. I can't pick up a phone and talk to them now. Say it's no longer possible because they're no longer with us.
Yeah, this we've seen a similar pattern in other hotspots around the world where the local investigators would be harassed and marginalized, ridiculed by the media, in some cases, like arrested on trumped-up charges and thrown in prison. There was the infamous case of John Ford, the Long Island UFO network director, whose team of researchers, himself included, had investigated two well-known UFO crashes there in Long Island, and because he was making so many waves, they trumped up charges against him and threw him into prison where he's still at, unfortunately. You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. My very special guest is Andrew Hennessy of Scotland, who's been talking about the UFO, ET, even perhaps demonic activity in the Gorebridge area. We're going to take a break, and we'll meet you at the top of the hour for part two. The Cosmic Switchboard Show is listener-driven and subscription-driven, so if you, the listener, feel so inclined and you feel that you believe in what we are doing, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com and subscribe and be a member. We'll be back at the top of the hour. Thank you.